Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Anthony Fenton. Anthony is an independent researcher. He's a journalist, and he contributes to many websites and writes on topics ranging from America's imperial wars, Canada-U.S. relations, and Haiti under occupation. He wrote a book on Haiti. Let me mention his website first. His website is webofdemocracy.org, and he co-authored a book with Yves Engler titled Waging War on the Poor Majority. Yes, indeed. He's working on a second book. I was looking to see if I could spot a title, but I don't have it. Anthony, are we connected? Not yet. We'll keep trying to get him. He's working on a second book nearly completed. And when we get him on the line, we'll get an idea what that book is all about. I wanted to talk about topics of most concern to Anthony today, including Haiti under occupation. It's a topic that I need to bring up on a regular basis on this program. There are so many things that we need to go over, so many vital issues. But Haiti very much is one of them, and especially because what's going on there is virtually blacked out in the U.S. media. Most people have no idea what's happening. They probably don't know where Haiti is. They don't know that the country is under occupation. It's really not a lot different than Iraq or Afghanistan, except there isn't a raging war going on. It's kind of a war by slow motion. And the occupiers are directed from Washington, and they're called UN peacekeepers. Well, they're not peacekeepers, they're occupiers. A couple of years ago, I wrote about the UN peacekeeping mission, and I called them UN peacekeeping paramilitaries. It's as true in Haiti as it is anywhere else. And in the case of Haiti, I believe a unique circumstance happened. February 29, 2004, the Bush administration sent the U.S. Marines into Haiti and deposed a democratically elected leader. Then a couple of months later, the U.N. Security Council, complicit with the U.S., authorized a so-called peacekeeping role, and it very likely is the first time in U.N. peacekeeping history that an occupation force was sent in not to return a democratically elected president to office, but to see to it that he doesn't come back. And they call themselves peacekeepers. Well, they have nothing to do with keeping the peace. They just ravage through poor neighborhoods. They shoot people in cold blood. People reacting freely, nonviolently, to the rights they believe they should have and they do, including wanting their democratically elected president back, which is really a bit past the board at this stage because there was another election in 2006, and a man who governed admirably for one term in the 1990s, Rene Préval, unfortunately came back in the role of being very subservient to the power interests. We've talked about it a little bit on this program. He was a good guy in the 90s, and he's a bad guy now. Let's take a break.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
NewsHour, and indeed I believe we're connected with Anthony Fenton. Anthony, are you on?
I am.
Oh, I must have slipped up and entered a wrong digit in your landline number. I shot you an email just to be sure I get right. I just requested, please send me that landline number again, and I'll be sure that I get it right. But we had your cell, so we got you on. All you missed was a good introduction.
Okay.
And a very, very brief background. I started talking about Haiti, and I hope we can get into that in more detail from your work and your book, plus whatever other topics are of major concern to you. Oh, there's so much. We'll cover as much as we have time for, Anthony. But I mentioned that you and Yves Engler, I guess a few years ago now, co-authored a book called Waging War on the Poor Majority. And I believe in it you covered some of the history of Haiti, the 2004 coup, the UN so-called peacekeepers, who I describe as paramilitaries. I call Haiti an occupied country, Anthony. Would you disagree with that?
No, I would not.
Talk about your book and your thoughts on Haiti today.
Sure. I first mentioned that was my mistake on the cell phone. I was the one who made the digit error when I sent you my email on my telephone number.
No problem. We get you on now.
Yeah. All right. Of course, yeah, that was in 2005 we wrote that. Both of us had traveled to Haiti in the meantime. I traveled there twice. I was there for the 1 month anniversary of the coup d'etat in 2004, in March 2004. March 29th, 2004 was the 1 month anniversary. And it was amazing. We were struck by the diametric opposites in realities. On the one hand, you had the media depicted reality of what had transpired in Haiti during that period. And then I went down with actually at the time a pretty large human rights delegation comprised of around 20, mostly, I was in fact the only Canadian, but mostly U.S.-based activists, human rights activists, professors, and so forth. And we discovered, you know, an entirely different set of circumstances. In fact, contrary to what the media had said, insisted that Aristide had resigned. You know, I'm sure you've gone over this many times, but probably the starkest reality when we hit the ground, and one of the memories that sort of seared in my mind was when we visited the National Palace in Port-au-Prince. And the first thing you notice there is just crawling with U.S. Marines. In fact, inside the National Palace itself, you had U.S. Marines bunked down. And this, it just strikes you as such a violation of Haiti's national sovereignty there. So the biggest symbol of their national sovereignty is literally occupied by U.S. Marines. And, of course, wasn't long before the U.S. Marines passed over the occupation, which they had begun with the Canadians, the French, and the Chileans, importantly. They passed it over to a Brazilian-led mission, which it remains today. And I started covering Haiti as a sort of a journal activist. there's a tremendous void, especially in the Canadian media, regarding some of the simple facts that were readily accessible about, that cast a shadow of doubt over the government and media spun narrative about Aristide the dictator, Aristide resigned, that this is a huge, massive popular protest that was seeking to sweep him out of office at the time. And so I just tried to do my part to fill that void while agitating for people to pay attention to what's going on there and oppose the coup, because in particular, there's quite a bit of silence from the left in North America. And so we linked up and connected probably with many of the people you've interviewed over the last couple of years on the show, people like Brian Kincannon and other activists in the U.S. that have really been leading voices opposing the coup, helping to document what happened there, in leading human rights investigations, and keeping Congress informed of what's going on, and so forth. And out of that developed all of the earliest efforts grew a network in Canada of called the Canada Haiti Action Network, sort of an ad hoc coalition of local solidarity organizations who who understood the realities of the coup and were opposed to it and organized against it and organized a number of cross-country tours of prominent journalists, filmmakers, and activists from Haiti itself, and brought these things to the attention of the Canadian people. And one small part of that was the idea to write a short book. Eve Engler and I did so, like I said, in 2005, and we, you know, used that as a tool to mobilize consciousness as well. We crossed the country. We actually did a few stops in the U.S. as well, and just, you know, used the book as a way to draw attention to what was going on in Haiti, what was Canada's role, and you know, out of that, it was an important period for me and my research because, you know, I mean, been studying, unfortunately, studying U.S. imperialism primarily, you know, for the radical periods of my life, you know, and never really had come across too much good content on Canadian foreign policy, Canadian imperialism, you could say. I mean, there is when you really begin to look at it. There's lots of great stuff over the years, but compelled me to look further into the Canadian state and the Canadian history of the Canadian national security and foreign policy and examine Canadian imperialism at its core. And that's what I've been doing ever since. And there you go. That's the book. I think we sold out of it a while ago, made about 4,000 copies of it. And it's time for another one, I think, for an updated one, because it's 4 years later. We're looking at... right now, 2004, a five-year occupation anniversary that was celebrated. Just this past weekend, Bernard Kouchner, the father of humanitarian imperialism, the foreign minister of France, was in Haiti with the Brazilian foreign minister, and what they're doing now is lobbying for a one-year extension of that occupation. And he said some very patronizing remarks. Mr. Kouchner basically said, you know, we should stay there throughout the next presidential elections, and we should, if we're going to hand over their affairs to them, you know, we want to be sure they're ready to do so. Very, very indicative and very symbolic of the career and life and times of Bernard Kouchner, one of the leading interventionist theorists and practitioners.
Oh, indeed, Anthony. Of course, the French have a couple of hundred years tradition of being the imperial power in Haiti. The Spanish came over, Hispaniola, Columbus, we know that story a little bit. We don't really know the story other than he came and he discovered America. Well, America was around. He just happened to come over here, and of course he wiped out the population of what's now Haiti and the Dominican Republic almost down to the last man, woman, and child. And then they brought black African slaves over. But then France replaced Spain as the imperial power, and they maintained the slave tradition, and then France gave way. The U.S. became the imperial power in the 20th century, and I'm sure you covered that Woodrow Wilson, that great Democrat, occupied the country for 35 years, including a couple of years under FDR, 1915 to 1935. And they were just as brutal then with U.S. forces. They were just as brutal then as the so-called peacekeepers are now. And one more comment, Anthony, and then I'll let you pick up. When I first began writing back in 2005, there were a few topics that just obsessed me, and I knew I had to say something about them. One was the situation in Iraq. The other was the democracy in Venezuela under Chavez. And the other was the terrible oppression of the Haitian people, especially after the 2004 coup and the U.S. Marines going in the middle of the night and abducting Aristide and rousting him, needless to say, without his consent or knowledge, and taking him to this oppressive country in the middle of Africa. He didn't even know where he was, the Central African Republic, and then absolutely prohibiting his right to come back. So he's now in exile in South Africa. But Haitians, to this day, as you know, they absolutely want him back. They just want him back in any capacity, simply to be in the country. He is the man that they love and they want. And, of course, he should have a right to go and live wherever he wants. But he's been laying low and doing probably the wise thing. Hopefully that one day will come and he'll be able to come back and at least live in his own country again.
Indeed, and you know, that's one of the things that they really tried to accomplish. The difference between, of course, the first coup against Aristide in the early 90s and the second coup was that they were able to, with some level of credibility, you know, in quote, scare quotes, create this picture of Aristide as somehow comparable to François Duvalier, baby doc Duvalier, previous to the last dictator, who's in exile in France. And nobody's really, other than the extreme elements of the right wing in Haiti, nobody's calling for him to return. And if he returned, it would strike fear into the hearts of most Haitians. Whereas with Aristide, the reality is he is a living symbol. If he were to ever return to Haiti, or he would return right now, he would show what a failure this occupation, so-called humanitarian or responsibility to protect intervention has been, because as we saw with the recent elections in Haiti, a massive boycott by Lavalas, which is still the most powerful political force in the country. They haven't changed that with two coups d'etats within a little more than a decade. And if he returned, Lavalas would support him. They would support whatever he does, you know, privately or in some other capacity politically. That's a paradox, because he can't return. They know that they can't support his return. Why hasn't Obama, the great Democrat, the Wilsonian Democrat, if you will, asked for Aristide to be permitted to return? It's absurd.
Indeed. So we need to take a break, Anthony, because why hasn't Obama done so much else instead of doing just the opposite of what his constituents elected him to do? But that's the way the system goes. Let's take a break and we'll come right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, along with Anthony Fenton. We're talking about Haiti. Of course, Anthony, Aristide was a former parish priest. He never wanted to have anything to do with politics. He was simply drafted by the Haitian people because they loved what he talked about in his sermons. And Haiti was repressively governed again for so many generations. And it looked like Aristide, if they could get a man like that to be their leader, there was a possibility there could be some change. And that's exactly what happened. But you mentioned the first coup. 90 or 91, I keep forgetting the dates. Haven't looked at it for a while. But took office early in the year. And by September of the same year, the generals overthrew him. And then he came back a few years later when Clinton got him supposedly to agree to be a different kind of Aristide. And to a modest extent, he did. He wanted to do whatever he could. And at the same time, he didn't want 3 months or 6 months to go by and be deposed again. So he basically tried to do everything that he could. And apparently he did too much. So he was rousted again by the Bush administration in the end of February, the February leap year date in 2004. And I've called Haiti, Anthony, for 500 years, they've been so repressed, and I refer to Haiti as possibly the most repressed people anywhere in the world, because it's gone on for 500 years, and they certainly are the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere. And when food prices skyrocketed last year, Haitians were literally starving, and then the country was hit by the terrible storms a year ago last summer, and the horrendous damage it did. And I think very little has been done to repair it, except what Haitians can do on their own. So the idea in Haiti, as in every place else, the imperial powers want their way. They want to do nothing but exploit the local population. Haiti is not rich in resources like Iraq is with its oil. But Haiti is very rich in one resource, cheap labor, real cheap labor. So it is exploited to the hilt, of course, by the Haitian elite, the oligarch business people, and Washington. And Washington sets the rules, but of course it's a complicit arrangement with the big business people in Haiti. and the Haitian people all along now and in the past have been ruthlessly exploited.
Absolutely.
You've got a new book coming out. Is it again on Haiti or is it on a different topic?
It covers a little bit of what I've researched since then on with respect to Haiti. It's been difficult. One of the things I try to do is submit in a lot of Canadian access to information requests. And the process here, if you can believe it, is actually more labyrinthine and more restrictive and more secretive here in Canada than in the United States even, and makes it incredibly difficult. So I've been waiting for years on some documents that I've requested regarding, intricacies of Canadian policy on Haiti, just to try and get some of the answers from the inside there. But that's part of the book. The other parts, basically, it's a co-written book with John Elmer. He's a photojournalist and journalist and researcher who covers the Middle East primarily. And he and I have been analyzing the transformation of Canadian foreign policy, basically post 9/11 foreign policy. So that covers the major interventions of Haiti in order, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Haiti. And, of course, there's other elements that we look at as well, such as, Canada's involvement in training the coup force in Palestine in conjunction with the U.S. General Keith Dayton. There's a lot of these little symbolic things that Canada does around the world that gives it a power and influence they punch above their weight in the terms of Ottawa. Canada plays a significant role as what you could call a second-tier imperial or core power in the world in its own right. And it's not, as we sort of tend to disagree in the book with the thesis that, Canada's just a toady or just doing or performing the U.S. will, we're holding the belief code, I think, is one of the terms. So we've been looking at that transformation, particularly the transformation of the Canadian forces, the militarization of Canadian society and foreign policy, the shift in conjunction and parallel for the first time historically with the U.S., what we call now the counterinsurgency era 2.0. There was a counterinsurgency era that begun in the 1960s. Johnson, then Kennedy, specifically under the Kennedy era, and we've seen it now shifting under the first, the second Bush administration, which you could say is the first Obama administration, and then the current Obama administration has taken the counterinsurgency ball and is running with it, and we've looked at how Canada has in parallel transformed its own sort of entire foreign policy apparatus. What they call the whole of government. There's these little buzzwords that we've been analyzing, the 3D approach, the whole of government approach. It's very much this, it's interesting in that we've been studying this from the Canadian side for several years, and now we're just really seeing it reach fruition with the Obama administration. So some of the first pronouncements from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and so forth were reflective of this whole of government 3D approach. So it's interesting we're seeing a sort of a Canadianization of U.S. foreign policy, and we cover that.
Oh, my goodness. We need to take another break, Anthony. Holding the Bully's Code is the title of Linda McQuaig's book, and months back I had her on the program talking about it. Oh, a close alliance between Canada and the U.S. I can answer that briefly after we come back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
On with Anthony Fenton, talking about occupied Haiti, U.S.-Canada relations. I think the U.S. and Canada has a very special relationship. You've studied it so well, Anthony. Of course, Washington has a close alliance with many countries around the world. But if I had to pick three that I thought might stand out as the most important ones or the closest, I'd say Washington's relationship with Canada, with the U.K., and with Israel. And, of course, there are many others, and there are a good many that we simply co-opt. We either get their cooperation by hooker by crook, either by whatever benefits we can give them, slim that they may be, because whatever we give, we want to get back a lot more in return. And others, if they don't cooperate quite the way that we want them to, well, we just somehow arrange for someone else to come in and govern the country. And the idea that we want Democrats, Anthony, is one more element of pure fiction that this is what we try to promote around the world. We absolutely despise Democrats. We love working with dictators. It's a lot easier to get one guy, usually a man. Can't think of a woman dictator offhand. I guess there have been a few along the way. One does not come to mind presently in power. But it's a lot easier to get one guy to go along with what you want to do. And you sweeten the pie by making it lucrative for him as a junior partner. And you don't have to mess with messy Democratic elected officials. Some may want to do one thing. Some may want to do something else. That's a terrible way to run a country. I mean, we don't run our country that way. We say we do, but we certainly don't. Oh, my goodness. I wanted to ask you also, what is the title of your new book? And when it's done, would you alert me? Because I'd like to get you back to talk about it.
Well, absolutely. In fact, we've changed ideas for the title so many times. We said we're going to leave that till the end.
I do the same thing with articles. I start off with a working title, and then I may change it once. I may change it twice. With me, I suspect you as well. It depends on exactly what you end up putting in the book to pick the title that's most appropriate to describe it.
Yeah. So generally, of course, it's going to have something like, you know, the transformation of, you know, or Canada's 21st century's foreign policy, right? Because this is especially this counterinsurgency approach, you know, is what they say it's for Afghanistan and beyond. It's for the foreseeable future that Canada's going to be fighting these types of wars. And so that's why the Canadian military in particular, I was just revisiting an interesting documentary that CBC produced back in 2007 about the campaign really took place between 2005 and the end of 2007, still continues, but this is during a period when one of Canada's American/Canadian generals, Rick Hillier, was basically the Canada's equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Chief of Defense Staff here in Canada, Rick Hillier, who spent time, one of many generals who spent time on exchange, high-level exchange with the U.S. military. So he ran as deputy commander of Fort Hood, Texas, the U.S. Army III Corps back in the late 1990s. And ever since then, he's sort of been known as this general who's on the fast track to be rising to the top, and someone who's also very close to the U.S. In fact, his the guy who succeeded him, the current chief of defense staff, is also a product of that exchange program. And he was deputy commander of that same U.S. Army III Corps in Iraq after the invasion in 2004. But returning to the point, when Rick Hillier took over, he came in as a skillful practitioner of the art of public relations, and he built within the Canadian forces literal like a platoon of public relations specialists. They set up this office where there are 500 Canadian soldiers, civilians, dedicated to the task of propagating, basically, U.S. military propaganda. And this massive effort called Operation Connection took place, where you saw a campaign to literally sell the Canadian forces to the entire Canadian society. And in that, out of that period, we've seen, Canadian military budget nearly double. We've seen, obviously, the commitment, the shift from relatively peaceful Kabul at the time, to Canada's, full-on intense involvement in this, in a hornet's nest, as they say, in southern Afghanistan. We've seen resources go into creation of special military units like the Joint Task Force 2, which is equivalent to, it's like the top-tier special forces. These guys are respected around the world. And they're actually considered, alongside Canada's tar sands, a strategic asset for the Canadian state. That's how important special forces are, and they've grown that and so forth. And so this is sort of gets to the heart of what we've been looking at, the shift inside the shift. And a big part of it, though, is the shift in propaganda, the shift in the way that they've really tried to manipulate the psyche of the Canadian society in order to, if not support the shift, to not oppose it. And so it's been sort of disturbing the lack of, a mass movement to oppose the shift generally, but also, say, the war in Afghanistan that's just really continuing to escalate. Canada's committed to being there in full force. We're talking 3,000, a mere 3,000 soldiers relative to the more than 100,000 that are pouring into Afghanistan now, foreign forces on top of the private mercenaries that are there. But the fact that we've seen very little by way of a mass mobilization against this shift is pretty disturbing. But you look at what we are up against, no surprise. I mean, it's not much different than, of course, and these are always in parallel to the new methods in psychological warfare that were developed under the Bush administration, and not to mention the intimidating, the psychological effect of the domestic wiretaps and domestic spying, which goes on here just like it does there. I mean, we have secret agencies like the NSA. Ours is called the Communications Security Establishment. Very few people, even if they know about it, are aware of that they operate very closely with the NSA in the U.S. and so forth. And we also had in that period the evolution of Canadian foreign intelligence gathering. So Canada's Security Intelligence Service has sort of begun to take on parallel roles to the Central Intelligence Agency. And you can see where this is leading us, right, leading us into this permanent national security state. Whereas, on the other hand, since the Cold War, since World War II, the Canadian state has tried to present itself as a peaceable nation, a peacekeeping, an exceptional nation, one that doesn't have an imperial past, one that is a peacekeeping nation, one that is an honest broker, all these sort of narratives. So you have these conflicting narratives with the new reality that the generals and Canada's quite considerable defense lobby have been trying to break the hold of these old peacekeeping myths and create a new reality that Canadian society has to deal with.
It's been a long time since I've looked into that and paid attention to writings like from Linda McQuaig on Canada's history. But if I remember, it's been a couple of years, but if I remember, Anthony, you once had a prime minister, Lester Pearson, I believe, who took a public stand against the Vietnam War. I don't know whether that won him a Nobel Peace Prize, but he is the one who won it. Do I have that right?
Well,
Lester Pearson?
You're right that's the sort of the memory of him, but that's sort of, another myth.
Well, he was never such a truly honorable guy, but compared to the Stephen Harpers that you have now, he was at least a bit of a different breed.
Yeah, it's sort of like the difference between a Bush and an Obama, right?
Oh, dear. I would call that no difference at all.
Well, like, for example, like that image of Pearson, the peacekeeper, right? He did win a Nobel Prize for his involvement in the Suez Crisis.
Oh, was it the Suez Crisis? Okay.
But he, in fact, one of the best and most inspiring books written about Canadian foreign policy that period was by a historian by the name of Victor Levant, who wrote called Quiet Complicity, about, and there's a history of Canada's involvement in Vietnam, right? So if you ask the average Canadian, even those who were alive during the period, whether or not Canada was involved in Vietnam, they would say, no, Canada wasn't. But here he has this massive, PhD dissertation, which he had to whittle down from 1,000 pages to whatever, 400 pages, that documents Canada's complicit role in the war in Vietnam. And very much parallels the 2003 war in Iraq in the sense that Jean Chrétien, who was Canadian Prime Minister at the time, is remembered fondly as the Prime Minister who kept Canada out of Iraq, when in fact, even as the media themselves reported at the time, this wasn't the case. That Canada was one of the largest supporters of the Iraq war, both militarily, diplomatically, financially in terms of aid and so forth. Supported the occupation, legitimized it, and the consequence of that is that we see upwards of 15 Canadian oil and gas companies that are in Iraq right now benefiting from the opening up of Iraq's oil fields.
You're talking about the companies, the profiteers, but Canada did not send troops to Iraq. They just had a division of labor. The U.S. sent troops, obviously, the U.S., the occupier. Numerous other countries did. Most of them are pulled out now, even the U.K. Abandoning ship. But the new frontier is Afghanistan. And if that isn't a parallel with Vietnam, I don't know what is. The U.S. Commander, Stanley McChrystal, to me, he reminds me of General Westmoreland back in the Vietnam era, wanting more and more troops. I don't know that they'll get up to 550,000, which was about the number that we had in Vietnam, but he wants more, and he wants more, and he wants more. And I believe a public statement was made that they're not really sure they can win this war. They just need more troops to keep it from being any worse than it already is. My thought is the more troops they send over there, the worse, in fact, it will get. And Canada is involved with troops on the ground in Afghanistan. What do the people of Canada say about this?
Well, like most of the populations that have of countries that have are part of the foreign occupation, they're opposed, right? The majority everywhere, virtually, as far as I can tell, are opposed to it. But I don't know what the reasons are. I mean, just today for their opposition, right? Today there's another poll that came out and said Canadians, overwhelming amount of Canadians want to return to peacekeeping. They want Canada's military to return to peacekeeping, right? So that's always a difficult one for me to swallow because Haiti, the coup in Haiti, was a quote-unquote peacekeeping mission, right? So it's like, do we want to return to a myth, right? We want to return to a mythical place. But there is opposition to what they see, you know, the body bags, right? So they don't like seeing body bags coming home with the frequency they've been coming home, 131 Canadian soldiers now, which was when you compare it to Vietnam, right? Of course, this is very small, but that's 21st century war. The idea is to minimize the casualties and win the population over to these types of wars.
Are those images shown on TV on the CBC?
No, absolutely not. No, that's one of the things. Of course, we have a media embed program, and that's another phenomenon that they've incorporated in the Canadian Forces is an embed program that prevents and precludes the publication of these types of images.
So the public may hear about it. They may read reports, those who actually read them. But that's a big difference from seeing images on TV of dead soldiers coming back. That could arouse people quite a bit. There's no question that I would think they would want to keep that out of the news, off television screens. And, of course, none of that happens down here in the U.S. And, of course, the embeds.
yeah. Well, you saw just recently when it did happen. An AP reporter reported an image of the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
And that was causing outroar out of the Pentagon, right? So. Yeah, they would. There was a big debate whether or not even to show the televised the coffins, the ramp ceremonies, in when the soldiers' bodies were returned to Canada. You know, and so yeah, for sure, it's one of the things that's dealt with. You know, there's definitely a huge level of sanitization of the war.
Oh, it's disgusting, Anthony. If this program were on television instead of radio. And if I got hold of those images, I guarantee you I would plaster them all over the screen and make a very, very big deal about them. Of course, we don't reach millions of listeners. That's the only problem. But I would spread the word as I could. We can talk about it, but it's not quite the same as seeing body bags of dead soldiers coming back. And there's no earthly reason why they ever should have been sent over there in the first place to fight an imperial war, whether it's the aggressor itself, the U.S., or whether it's another country complicit with the aggressor, meaning they are now an aggressor as well. Canada very definitely is an aggressor country fighting an imperial war.
And, you know, I wanted to back up just for a minute, because one thing about Canada is that it came out in a book, sort of an insider written by a couple of, you know, members of the Canada's sort of academic elite, but they did an insider account of the steps that led to Canada's role in southern Afghanistan. And they had a chapter that covered the Iraq War. And they basically, the former minister, Canada's former minister of defense, said that when he met with Rumsfeld in 2003, early 2003, before the invasion, Rumsfeld said flat out, we don't want you to have to send in soldiers into Iraq. We need them basically in Afghanistan. And so it's this whole notion of fungibility, or what you call backfilling. So the Canadian soldiers that could go patrol Kabul would free up U.S. U.S. soldiers who could go into Iraq, and it's, six of one, half dozen of the other sort of thing. But the other thing is that, Canada has devoted a considerable amount of military assets. And Canada's the number one supplier of military weaponry and components and so forth to the U.S. military. And it plays an integral role. Like, without Canada, any of the U.S. wars couldn't take place. So in that respect, I think that's important to mention. But yeah, in Afghanistan, the Canadian commitment there has been just absolutely integral to the overall, you could say, the legitimacy of it all, right? Maintaining this NATO fig leaf on the operation, showing, lending credibility as the good war, as the war of necessity, as Obama said. And that's a really, really important role that Canada plays. And this is something that they're conscious about in Washington and in Ottawa. So, like, this narrative that Canada has a lack of an imperial past is utilized, like, strategically. The U.S. says quite openly, like, Canada is free of most of the suspicion that limits Washington's ability. And Canada is on the operational side, they are the ones who get responsibility shifted to them when Washington, the perception of Washington, could, prevents them from doing it themselves. And so that's very much the role of Canada in all this.
All this sanitized images, whether it's of your country, Canada, Anthony, or others, America is a glorious democracy. You strip away that mask, it's an entirely different story. One more break, and then we'll be back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Some final comments with Anthony Fenton. Anthony, I just want to mention your website again, webofdemocracy.org, and your last book, Haiti, Waging War on the Poor Majority, a new one still in progress, so far untitled, but I can't wait to find out about it when you get it done. And just one more comment, and then you wrap up. As Canada has increasingly catered more to its corporate interest and become more militarily entwined with the U.S., Your once fairly decent social safety net has been over time whittled away, depleted, including your universal single payer healthcare system that may not be perfect, but it sure beats the dickens out of what we have down here that leaves 50 million roughly today uninsured. And by a study that I quoted, 200,000 more people every single month losing their health coverage. So if they really have a serious health problem, they are in very, very big trouble. But some final comments from you, Anthony.
Absolutely. And again, thank you for having me on the show, Stephen.
Oh, delighted to have you.
You talk about what you implicitly talked about there was the neoliberal turn in Canada, throughout the, most West, all Western states went through in some form or another. Canada is a leading G8 nation, right, one of the largest economies in the world. It's important that Canada be a leader in the shift to neoliberalism domestically, and that's, we could argue that that's what laid the groundwork for the eventual global expansion, the global export of neoliberalism, and Canada's been on the vanguard of the countries that have, shifted, the shock therapy throughout Eastern Europe in the former Soviet Union, immediately following the Cold War, the wars in the Balkans, and so on and so forth. And Canada's increasing footprint in Latin America, and as you said, the global transnational Canadian corporations. Few people know that there's so many Canadian mining companies operating abroad. There's more Canadian mining companies, pillaging the natural resources of the countries of the global south. than there are American companies. And they need, they obviously need the protection more so than the Canadian force. They need the protection of the U.S. empire and their empire of military base and so forth. And it only stands to reason in that respect that Canada has it as its number one top foreign policy priority, good relations, close relations with the United States. And we can see with the last 8 years the road that's leading us down. And, you mentioned, we've been working on this book, and the transformation happened so quickly. You know, we try and keep up with everything. And our original plan was to have it out over a year ago at least, but it looks like it's probably going to come out in 2010. Absolutely, I'll alert you to that when it comes out. And in the meantime, we're just trying to continue doing our work, doing a number of ongoing investigations. As I've alluded to, I've been looking at Canada's role in Iraq. Recently, I've got an article out in the current issue of This Magazine, it's called. It's this.org. It's about Canada's private companies that have been profiting off the war in Iraq, especially in and around the oil sector. And it's important not only because Canada is the largest energy supplier to the U.S. economy, that led Canadians to call themselves an energy superpower, but Canada imports a lot of Iraqi oil, and it's contingent upon the continuous flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz, and that very much plays into Canada's global policy. And I guess I should wrap it up.
We could wrap it up. I wish we could go on. So much more we could talk about, Anthony. But you know what? That just opens the door to get you back so we can pick up on this discussion.
Sounds good.
Again, my great thanks to Anthony for coming on. Important stuff. And most people have no idea about the relationship between the U.S. and Canada. You filled in a lot of the blanks, and we'll do more on future programs. And to my listeners, please join us again tomorrow. We'll have another vital discussion with a distinguished guest. Join us then.